that's the cultural connection that we're missing right now, is the ability to share and to feed our families our cultural foods.
The Yukon River salmon collapse is hurting Alaskans and Canadians along the 2,000-mile river. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 8th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, some family treasures washed out to sea by the Juno flood find their way back home.
It could have hit a tree and popped open, and all of that would have been lost forever. It was meant to make its way back to the family.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
A federal judge Monday dismissed a lawsuit filed by the state of Alaska and its Economic Development Agency that challenged a 2021 Biden administration move to suspend oil leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's according to reporting by the Northern Journal. President Joe Biden, immediately after taking office, ordered a supplemental review of the federal government's refuge leasing program and directed a suspension of development-related activity while the review played out. A similar action followed a few months later from Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, and the supplemental environmental review has not yet been completed. Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or AIDA, both challenged those decisions, joined by the North Slope Borough and two Alaska Native corporations from the area. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason, in a 74-page order Monday, dismissed the case. Officials from AIDA and Dunleavy's administration did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The two largest wildfires in the state are burning in the Delta Junction area. As of yesterday, the Pogo Mine Road fire covered 40,000 acres around the underground gold mines access road and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline north of the Richardson Highway. The fire grew significantly over the weekend, and in an online update last night, Delta Area State Fire Management Officer Michael Goyette said firefighters are working on structure protection.
Well, the fire has been backing up through the structures to the pipeline.
But Goyette said the fire has primarily been advancing to the north-northeast.
Up through the mountains, away from the highway, the pipeline, and the power line, and some other residents. We are currently prepping for the homes and preparing them, if needed, along the Pogo Road at the entranceway.
The area's other big blaze, the over 46,000-acre Delta Fire, is burning on state and military lands in a limited suppression area south of the Richardson Highway, but smoke jumpers are protecting remote cabins in the fire zone. A third, smaller fire, the 7,000-acre Mount Hayes fire, is burning south of the Alaska Highway. Firefighters are using bulldozers to build line, and Goyette said they launched an air attack Monday when the fire crossed the Gerstle River.
A bunch of aircraft working on that, trying to hold it in between some of the sloughways and the Gerstle River.
Goyette also addressed the heavy wildfire smoke impacting the region, noting that while smoke causes health and safety issues, it's beneficial to firefighting.
When we have all this smoke that's setting down with the inversion, that keeps the fire behavior down. That allows the firefighters and equipment to get in there and try to get more fire line put in, get structures prepped.
Cooler temperatures and showers remain in the forecast, but there were nearly 2,500 lightning strikes yesterday in Alaska and the Yukon Territory. Many of the strikes were clustered in the Ray Mountains west of the Dalton Highway, south of the Koyukuk River. Well, for decades, chum and king salmon runs on the Yukon River have become more unpredictable, and now both species are in a historic collapse. That's jeopardized the health and livelihoods of Alaskans along the river, but it's not just a problem for Alaskans. Across the border, Canadian communities are also missing those fish. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George explains how both countries depend on each other to conserve this vital resource.
The Yukon River covers a lot of ground on its nearly 2,000-mile journey to the sea. The river's headwaters are in British Columbia, and from there it winds north through the Yukon, crosses the border near Eagle, and flows all the way across interior Alaska until it finally reaches the Bering Sea. And for as long as people can remember, king salmon fed everyone along its course.
For most of our lives, it was king salmon that was the majority of our diet and what we traded and what we processed.
That's Rhonda Pitka, chief of the village of Beaver in the Upper Yukon Flats. Pitka remembers busy summers as a child with her family at their fish camp about 10 miles outside the village, helping her grandmother catch and process fish. But today, she can't continue that tradition. In the last 4 years, King and Chum runs have dropped so low, managers have all but closed subsistence fishing. It's challenging for families to get enough food just to last the winter, Pitka says, and salmon is missing from local traditions.
This summer has been pretty rough because we had a couple of deaths in Stevens Village. That's a village that's really close to Beaver. And, you know, we didn't have fish to pass out at the potlatch.
It's changing life on the Yukon, and not just in Alaska. Communities along the Upper Yukon, stretching deep into Canada, have borne the brunt of the salmon collapse, in part because only a fraction of the fish make it that far. Some Canadian First Nations have restricted fishing for decades. Pitka serves on the Yukon River Panel, a body of representatives from both Alaska and Canada that advises managers on both sides of the river.
You know, our Canadian counterparts haven't fished for at least 20 years, if not longer. And that's a tragedy all in itself. It's been really difficult. It's been really tense.
She says it's been a challenge to discuss resource allocation for a river that's not actually meeting anyone's subsistence needs. The panel was established by the Yukon River Salmon Agreement, a treaty that the U.S. and Canada signed in the early 2000s to make sure people on both sides of the river are able to fish. John Linderman is the U.S. co-chair. He says as part of that agreement, Alaska committed to making sure a certain number of fish cross into Canada.
Each country has its own responsibilities under the treaty agreement. For Alaska, one of our most important responsibilities is to annually provide to the Canadian border so that it goes into Canada, the escapement goal and the Canadian harvest share.
Escapement goal and harvest share. That means enough fish make it back to their spawning grounds to ensure a healthy salmon population, and in better years, enough fish on top of that to allow a fair harvest. Holly Carroll is the Alaska Subsistence Fisheries Manager for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She says the treaty can sound like a burden for Alaskans, especially during the last 4 years when managers have heavily restricted subsistence fishing. But she says that's the wrong way to look at it.
People will say, just let us fish. I don't take more than I need. My family does not take more than I need. And every family will tell you that. And they mean it and they are honest. But here's the problem. When our runs are too small to meet everyone's needs, we have to close.
Lately, there aren't enough salmon returning to the river to ensure healthy runs in the future. And that means everyone on the river, Alaskan and Canadian, has to step back. The treaty keeps both sides working together to protect the salmon, but that doesn't mean it's easy, says Rhonda Pitka from Beaver. She recalled the potlatch after the recent deaths in Stevens Village.
This last week was so, it was so hard to see families not have salmon to give out at potlatch, you know? There should have been salmon on everybody's plate. They should have been able to give salmon out to visitors that were leaving. Like that's the cultural connection that we're missing right now, is the ability to share and to feed our families our cultural foods.
Right now, that's a pain that's felt on both sides of the border. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, endangered sea lions found shot to death have prompted a reward from authorities.
In this case, I don't know. We're not sure why people would injure, harm, kill sea lions in the area.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life, getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope. there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share-your-strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
One man is dead and his co-worker is in jail after a fatal stabbing Monday at a lodge in Trapper Creek, according to Alaska State Troopers. Troopers say they got a report around 10 a.m. Monday that 21-year-old Jose Torres Ayala of Florida had been stabbed and seriously injured at Mount McKinley Princess Wilderness Lodge. He was medevaced from the lodge, but was later declared dead. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation determined that 33-year-old Michael Melendez had stabbed Torres Ayala in the lodge's restaurant. Melendez was arrested on charges of first-degree and second-degree murder. Troopers say both Torres Ayala and Melendez worked at the lodge and both were from out of state. The motive behind the workplace stabbing remains under investigation. Melendez is in custody at the Matsu pretrial facility. An Anchorage man is charged with trying to meet up for sex with a 13-year-old girl who was really an FBI agent posing as a minor online, according to a charging document. Federal authorities say they arrested 41-year-old Benjamin Roundy early Saturday. The charges filed Monday describe in detail Roundy's sexually explicit messages to the fictitious girl through July and into August and his attempts to convince her to meet him in person. On two occasions in the past week, the charges say Roundy went to addresses the girl provided, trying to find her, though she had not agreed to meet him. It was Friday that Roundy was parked at a spot where he could see what he thought was the girl's friend's home, according to the charges. That's when the FBI took him into custody. The charges say investigators found over 2,000 photos and 200 videos in a folder on Roundy's phone, most of which appeared to be images of child pornography. Roundy's attorney did not immediately respond to a request for comment today. Federal prosecutors said in a written statement that the FBI is looking for any other potential victims Roundy might have had. They said he went by the name Alex, that's A-L-E-K-S, and anyone with additional information should contact the FBI Anchorage field office. Juneau residents displaced by record-breaking flooding along Mendenhall River are still figuring out what's next. Meanwhile, some are being reunited with personal belongings they probably thought were lost forever. KTOO's Adeline Baxter spoke to locals helping with the cleanup effort about what they found.
Local photographer Michael Penn was kayaking back from a camping trip with his family Sunday when they entered a debris field just off Douglas Island near where the Mendenhall River flows into the ocean.
I looked down the water, and then there was this Ziploc bag just floating there, full of pictures. There's probably, I don't know, between 60 and 80 pictures in there. I know how precious pictures are.
They'd been out of cell service range for the last few days. When they checked their phones, they learned about the glacial outburst flood and the homes destroyed along the Mendenhall River. Someone had put a label that said family on the bag. The seal had broken, and the photos were soaked in salt water. Luckily, Penn has a print dryer left over from his darkroom photography days. He took the photos home, rinsed them, and dried them off.
There's no damage to them. If it had sat in the water for any length of time, they probably would have fallen apart.
He posted on Instagram, hoping to find the owners. The same day Penn found the photos, Letitia McRae was walking along the tideline of North Douglas, several miles from where the homes collapsed. She's been picking up trash in Juneau for about a decade. She runs a community Facebook page where she posts about her cleanups.
There was this big tree in the tide line, and kind of up against the tree was this wood box. And I picked it up, and lo and behold, that little latch with no lock, no nothing on it, was still closed.
When she opened the wooden box, she found an old metal photograph and jewelry, including what looked like a wedding band with a name inscribed on it. She took it home and rinsed everything off, then posted a picture on Facebook asking for help. A few hours later, a commenter connected her with someone who lost their home in the flood. She returned the box to its owner that evening.
That box made it. That really turbulent river, and then it floated all the way across the channel and ended up on a beach still closed. I mean, it could have hit a tree and popped open, and all of that would have been lost forever. It was meant to make its way back to the family.
On Monday, Penn went back to North Douglas with his family to continue the cleanup. He said they filled several bags.
Imagine a house that's been ground up and spat out. We were finding roof material and ceiling trusses and broken furniture and just bits of plastic. There's insulation everywhere.
Reports of furniture and building materials are popping up along the waters surrounding Juneau. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has asked residents to report any fuel or heating oil tanks that may have been swept away or found washed up on the shore. The cleanup will take some time, but on Monday morning, McRae was back out on the beach looking for more trash to pick up or more treasures to reunite.
Sometimes when you think it's all lost, it's not all lost, and sometimes the universe brings things back to you.
Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Adeline Baxter.
And a couple updates to that story. Michael Penn was able to track down the owner of the photos yesterday. Also, Juneau city leaders issued a local emergency declaration last night, and Governor Mike Dunleavy issued a state disaster declaration today. Residents who've been displaced because of the flooding can contact floodresponse@juneau.gov if they need shelter, food, or other resources. A small team of researchers is on the Yukon River this month to learn more about an area where dinosaur footprints were discovered 10 years ago. As KYUK's Emily Schwing reports, the first few days of the expedition have been fruitful.
I'm combing the banks of the Yukon River with paleontologist Tony Fiorillo.
Do you see anything?
Oh. It's right there. He just stumbled upon two small shapes protruding from a large block of yellow sandstone. One looks like a flattened tennis ball with three distinct toes. It's at least 100 million years old.
That's really cool. So, like, that's a little one.
And so it's either another body size of a dinosaur that lived here.
Yeah.
Or it's a baby.
Fiorillo is the executive director of the New Mexico Museum of Natural History and Science. He says this footprint was made by a dinosaur that comes from a group broadly known as ornithopods. They're plant eaters, and this is the smallest print from this dinosaur he's ever found. We're somewhere between Galena and the village of Nulato, where Fiorillo also discovered signs of an ancient fish species.
What this surface is an ichnogenus called Undicna. And what it is it's a trace fossil of a fish, a bony fish.
He points to three evenly spaced raised lines that scrape the surface of a grayish sandstone.
And it's as the fish is swimming and its fins are hitting the bottom, the rays of the fins will do that.
Fiorillo, who's an expert on the dinosaurs that once roamed Alaska, visited the upper reaches of the Yukon River six times between 2000 and 2013, and he only ever found two dinosaur footprints there.
That's the hardest I ever worked for, two footprints.
Now we're here in the middle section of the river.
So contrast that length of time for success. We go, wow, there's some rocks by the river yesterday. We arrive in the afternoon. I think it might have taken an hour to find the first footprint. I wouldn't say the floodgates are opened yet, but I think we're going to feel like that pretty soon at the rate we're finding stuff.
By the end of the second day of field work, the three-man team recorded nearly a dozen fossil footprints. In the following few days, that number has more than doubled. They plan to continue their search through the middle of August. On the Yukon River, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Whether this is your first try to quit or you've been down this path before, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help you quit for good. Get help creating a plan that is right for you, no matter if you smoke cigarettes, vape, use smokeless tobacco, or ICMIC. With options like calling a coach, receiving text messages, and nicotine replacement therapy with patches or gum, you can quit your way at any time of day or night. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
We'll be right back.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg will visit Alaska next week. His office announced visits to Kotzebue, Anchorage, and Juneau. The trip is intended to highlight the unprecedented level of federal spending on the state's infrastructure made possible by the bipartisan infrastructure law. The Biden administration says the state's total as of last month comes to $5 billion spread across more than 900 projects. About half of the money is for highways, bridges, and other transportation infrastructure. The state is also in line to receive $1 billion for broadband expansion and a substantial amount for water projects. A visit by a cabinet secretary also allows the state's congressional delegation to focus high-level attention on its priorities. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan will accompany Buttigieg in Kotzebue, while Senator Lisa Murkowski will join him on his southeast swing. More than 20 endangered sea lions have been found dead in the Copper River Delta this summer, many with gunshot wounds. The National Marine Fisheries Service has now quadrupled the reward for information on the illegal killings to $20,000. Sadie Wright, a biologist with the agency, says the dead animals were found during surveys of the area east of Cordova. This year, she says it's an unusually high number.
We've done this for a number of years, and this year we've found a big spike in number of dead sea lions on the islands there.
As of June 2nd, they'd found 7 dead sea lions in the area. Since then, at least 15 more have been reported. Wright says by this time in previous years, they'd found about 3 or 4. Stellar sea lions are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. Killing them is illegal. The only exception is for subsistence hunting by Alaska Native people. This isn't the first time numerous sea lions have been killed in the area, though. Wright says in 2015, fishermen illegally shot sea lions they saw as a threat to their livelihood. But Wright says they're still not sure what is behind this year's spike.
So we know that that has happened in the past. In this case, I don't know. We're not sure why people would injure, harm, kill sea lions in the area.
The endangered sea lion population is already facing challenges like the marine heat wave, and Wright says these killings hurt their chances of recovering.
A lot of these animals that we're seeing out there dead are young animals in their prime, so it's sad to see them die when there doesn't seem to be a good cause for it.
Wright says people can report harm or harassment of marine mammals to NOAA law enforcement at 1-800-853-1964. The Alaska Federation of Natives is fishing for photos to share at its convention this October, and it's offering prizes for those which best reflect this year's theme, Our Ways of Life. The contest opened at the beginning of the month, and Ben Malott, AFN's Vice President of External Affairs, says there's already been quite a catch.
We're already getting a couple hundred pictures already, and each picture is just super special.
Malott says the contest will help to generate interest in the convention, but also has another important purpose.
We plan to use the photos that we get throughout our convention materials, look at our app, look at our convention guide. Hopefully we can use photos that show our ways of life throughout all of our materials.
Malott says the more photos, the better, so they can be used after the convention to help AFN continue to advocate for Native causes.
AFN works in so many different arenas and so many different policy areas that sometimes having the right picture really brings it home.
AFN wants photographs that capture Alaska landscapes, hunting, fishing, families, elders, youth, regalia, and other daily activities or special events. Malott is also looking for contest judges. He says they'll definitely have their work cut out for them, but should enjoy it all. So far, many of the photos capture children and elders taking part in subsistence activities. Malott says one of his personal favorites is a snapshot of a little boy posing alongside a freshly caught fish, making a fish face. The contest is open to all Alaska residents 18 years or older and ends on September 1st. Entries can be submitted on AFN's website. The first prize is 2 round-trip Alaska Airlines tickets with $500 in cash for second place and $250 for third. Neighborhoods in Haines are resonating with air horns, barking dogs, and the occasional gunshot. The Bears are back in town, but as KHNS's Alan DePremenil reports, they aren't getting into too much trouble, at least compared to years prior.
Since early May, the Haines Police Department has received 37 reports of bear activity in town. Carl Koch is a wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. That number isn't alarming to him.
37 reports, that seems like it's down quite a bit from some past years.
The bears are sniffing around for trash and getting into fruit trees. Despite the complaints of their human neighbors, they are being good bears. 3 summers ago, a food shortage drove them to break into houses and vehicles at an alarming rate. Around 50 bears were killed in Haines that year, most of them for scrounging around human habitations. This year, apart from the noise we make to chase them away, the bears aren't much of a disturbance. But there are some outliers. Some of the police reports detail the work of one particularly busy sow.
There was a bear getting into cars. It had learned how to open car doors, and it was breaking into garages.
On July 15th, according to the police report, she was killed by a property owner after breaking into his shop. Her cub was also killed. Karsh says he hasn't heard a single report of property damage since then. The mother and her cub were the only bear fatalities reported in town this year. Following all the bloodshed that happened 3 years ago, Fish and Game implemented a new rule to keep bear deaths down. It states that if 2 female bears are killed in 1 year, the agency will cancel the hunting season. Karsh says Haines has already reached that limit, but he and his colleagues looked at the numbers over the last 3 years and decided that the average mortality was low enough to proceed with the hunting season.
So we're not going to close the fall season yet, but very likely if 1 more female is killed, we will close the fall hunt.
Koch wants to remind residents to secure their garbage. He says there are many ways to keep bears away from attractants. Residents can appeal to volunteers to come and pick their fruit trees. Fish and Game has electric fences residents can borrow, and there are grants available to assist with their purchase. Bears are better off when they are kept away from us. For KHNS, I'm Alan DePremenil.
And finally tonight, a correction. A story July 27th about funding increases for the Cooper Landing Bypass Project incorrectly stated that cost issues would not cause delays in the completion date of the project. The completion date could be delayed by between 2 and 4 years. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Kavitha George, Chris Clint, Adeline Baxter, Liz Ruskin, Dev Hardiker, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Emily Schwing out there on the Yukon River, and Alan DePremenil in Haines. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.